In the summer, in the city, when the girls are so pretty, I feel like I'm walking on the clouds. When the sun shines down, in the summer, in the city, when the girls are looking so pretty, with all those nice fresh fruits and vegetables tended by vendors on the side of the street making a living. In the summer, in the city, when the girls are so pretty. The heat and temperature is rising much faster than your spine can contemplate all the implications upon you now. The summer, the city, things are heating up. In the summer, in the city, you have a half full cup. In the summer, in the city, when the girls are so pretty.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from the fabulously summery Island Chains Nation of New Zealand, where we are bathing in the warmth and our own sweat simultaneously. And my very special guest is Mark Passio. Mark, welcome to the program.
Vinnie, it's great to be back on your show here today.
Hey, I wanted to make a point that I cannot offer enough, like, you know how back in ancient Egypt, you know, people would like prostrate themselves at the masters and what have you. I kind of want to do that to you because I listened to that. What's it called? The New Age bullshit presentation, and like all the way through it, I was like, yes, yes, yes. I couldn't help myself.
I'm really glad you found the information valuable. No need to prostrate yourself or anyone else.
It's
just information out there for people to learn, that's all.
I know there's no need, but, you know, it doesn't stop the compulsion to just go, frick, Mark's awesome, and he sussed it, right? And I was just thinking about this. This is, like, one of my favorite new subjects now is this New Age religion. And we had award-winning journalist and author Ian Wishart from New Zealand on Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie not too long ago. And he said part of the New World Order global government agenda, as outlined in his new book, Totalitaria, is to create a new religion. And that religion's ability to be accepted by everybody will only be accepted by everybody if all current religions are corrupted to a degree and that all of their principles get violated so that they can accept a new one into it, kind of thing.
Sure. You know, that's part of their plan is take down a lot of existing institutions that people once had faith in and push everybody into, you know, this universal hierarchical system that many researchers have called the New World Order, which does include both government and religion. There is a religious component to it, of course, for people of a more right brain or religious persuasion.
Mm-hmm. Now, can you tell me precisely exactly what this religion is going to look like? And is one of these underlying principles a denial of objective truth?
Well, absolutely. I think the very basis of this system is what I would call solipsism. It's another, you know, it's, you can call it whatever you like and euphemize it however you like, but at the core, it is a solipsistic belief system. And what solipsism basically is the idea that there is no such thing as objective truth, that one can never really truly know anything, that everything is just a matter of perception and, you know, just seeing things from a different viewpoint or perception, but there's no actual objective reality. And at the core of the New Age movement, I would say it is solipsism, and most people don't even realize that and don't even know what that ideology is or what it's about. They've never even really made a study of it on their own. But when you look at a lot of New Age belief systems, that they have overwhelming similarities to solipsism in many cases.
What is the origin of solipsism?
You know, I don't really know, to be honest. I don't know where it came from or was derived from. It comes out of older philosophies, and I would expect that this goes back right into the ancient world. I feel that what the ideology really comes from is extreme right-brained imbalance. It is a chronic imbalance toward the right brain hemisphere, because the right brain hemisphere is the sort of the parallel processor of the brain that sees the big picture of everything and doesn't like focus in on laser-like precision on details and break things apart. Now, that's not to say that the right brain is not absolutely very, very important. The right brain, enables human intuition, and it enables us to see large patterns, which is extremely important. Patterns over time as well are very much to be able to see those are made possible by engagement in right brain modalities. Mm. However, when you go too deep into these modalities and you stay there chronically without engaging the logical capabilities of the left brain hemisphere and actually using the analytical capabilities of the left brain side of the mind, then you you fall into these patterns of naivete and belief and just acceptance of things that should not be accepted, that you should not be comfortable with. And then it becomes an ideology that just says, well, you're not going to get to the root of any of it. That's not even possible, because it's all just a matter of opinion and perception, and each person's opinion and perception is equally as valid as the next person, since there's absolutely no such thing as objective truth and reality. And I think that's a very dangerous slope to go down, because it basically leads to moral relativism by saying, since there is no truth, there is no such thing as truly the difference between right and wrong behavior. And that's the slippery slope that many people go down when they enter these new age belief systems.
Now, if you do think about this, and I've had a number of conversations with new agers along these lines, and the propensity to act like a religious person, I mean, you take the quintessential Bible thumper kind of thing, who doesn't really know the Bible, is incredibly aggressive whenever people question it, and has a justification for absolutely everything, even doing moral ill will towards other people. That was the exact same impression that I got from having arguments with these people. What my concern is that this religion, this cult, is growing, and it's evidenced all around me a lot of the time, because I see a lot of people in the so-called truth movement, who are supposed to, you know, be about the truth, buying into this, locked, stock and barrel, and indeed defending it even when contrary facts are introduced, and saying that those facts aren't facts because facts don't exist, reality doesn't exist. They're trying to argue something that they cannot prove or justify. And that is what was inherently scary for me, is that how many regimes throughout history have committed absolute atrocities by saying that we can do all of this without any evidence, just because we say so, that is justified.
Right. Right. And, you know, that's really the basics for a eugenics-based society, and it's a basis for a totalitarian society, that the bulk of the population, since they're going to be buying into this right-brained imbalanced religion, this global religion, are never going to resist, because resistance is something that they claim is anathema and should never be practiced and should never be engaged in. Again, it's a religion of total acceptance of everything, including evil. And even they'll say it's not even evil. They'll claim that there's no such thing as good or evil. So everything is just an experience in this religion, and therefore all is allowed. Everything is, you know, should be permitted and accepted. And again, I think there's no discernment in an ideology like that. What I've advocated from day one is discernment and understanding the differences between objective right and objective wrong, and then using our willpower, you know, and our care, our true compassion, to really choose willfully and actively between those two modalities of behavior and choose the moral right over the moral wrong in all instances in our lives. That wouldn't even be possible in the quote-unquote New Age religion because, again, since it takes on this ideology of that there is no objective truth, by definition, then there's no such thing as true right or wrong. And you hear a lot of this rhetoric in the movement through a lot of the gurus and teachers because they're actually trying to actively negate the concept of right and wrong. I hear people who follow a lot of these teachings constantly, all day long, you know, denying that there is such a thing as objective right and wrong, that these are dualistic, quote unquote. These are dualistic concepts, and they should be rejected as having a dualistic nature because dualism is an illusion. And while I definitely think all the different things that divide humanity into separate groups and, you know, like race and you know, different cultural religions and political ideologies and, you know, age and, you know, culture, all these things are different ways of dividing people, and it's a divide and conquer strategy. But when it comes to right and wrong, that is a real duality that exists in nature. And that's what I don't think many people who subscribe to New Age belief systems understand, or they don't want to understand, because you have to understand, well, yeah, humanity really truly is one. We are all one. I don't deny that concept, and all the ways that we see each other in a dualistic mindset, I do think sort of needs to be cast to the side, and we need to see ourselves as one living human family. I've said that from day one as well. But that doesn't mean you don't use your discernment to understand that there's absolutely a difference in behavior. And there's a difference between right behavior and wrong behavior. That type of dualism is real and needs to be understood. And we have to use our discernment to recognize that distinction and then choose between it.
This is correct. And I think that morality, and you use two words in your presentation, which I will never forget and I will use constantly from now on. These two words, moral obligation. Right. This was very important for me because I have, I guess I'm starting to adopt certain religious beliefs, practices, and so on and so forth, yet I'm not strictly adhering to any religious regime. I'm simply taking the grain of truth out of religions that I see and discard the whole beachfront of lies. You know what I'm saying?
And sure.
It occurs to me that what is happening with this New Age religion is that the sense of moral obligation is kind of like it has an ironic existence to them in that they will say that good and evil doesn't exist, and yet when you have a look at who this person is and what they do, they're actually mostly doing good in their life. You know, they're making health products, or they're helping people, sure, or they're meditating, or they're taking care of their family, or something of this nature, yet they say that they don't believe in good and evil. And I say, then why, if you don't believe that there's any such thing as good or evil, are you not doing equally as much evil than good? Okay? Unless your belief structure doesn't actually match what you're doing in your life.
Right. And there's that internal opposition that exists, you know, internally in their own, you know, aspects of their personality. Like you said, what they say that they are holding in their mind because of this belief system doesn't really jibe with their behavior in real life. You know, and that's, you know, you could prove that there's really no such thing as hardcore solipsist, but, you know, in nature, you know, and by just saying, well, would you be okay as a solipsist if I just attack you randomly and do some bodily harm to you for no reason? And no solipsist will say, yeah, that's fine, that's okay. You know, well, if there's no such thing as truth, then obviously it can't be true that I shouldn't do that or that I have no right to do that, because there would be no right or wrong, because it wouldn't be true that that's wrong. So then why would you have a problem if I did something like that? You know, it's an argument many people have brought up, and I think it definitely holds a lot of weight. And people don't even think about it at that simple level that, you know, obviously you can't really truly believe that because, again, your behavior, you know, contradicts it. You say you want certain things to be in place that go along with the concept of right and wrong, but you know your words say otherwise. Absolutely, I see that contradiction as well.
It is a religion of constant contradictions, and I have this theory that this contradiction that they're trying to make here is merely kind of like a blanket all effect. So let's say, for example, you were a totalitarian psychopathic scum, right? And you wanted to dominate society. And traditionally, how you dominate society is you just take people's guns. Then they just can't resist you. What's happening now is even more dangerous. They don't even have to confiscate your guns. They can just convince you that taking up arms to defend yourself won't help you defend yourself.
Or that's always wrong, because they'll claim that kind of defensive capacity to use force against an aggressor is violence, which my work has really tried to hammer home the distinction, the absolute distinction and total opposition, the total antithesis between force and violence. These are polar opposites. They are nothing like one another. Force is always used in a defensive capacity and not as an aggressor. You're not initiating force if you're using it defensively. Violence is so because it is the initiation of undue force that one had no moral right to ever take to begin with. So it matters who begins the aggressive act. Okay, that's the person who's committing the violence, and the person who would be responding by protecting their body with the amount of physical force required to repel or put down that attack is responding with defensive usage of force and not with violence. And this is a distinction that many quote-unquote new agers do not recognize and want to say that both of those acts, the initial aggressive act and the defensive retaliation using force, equate as violence. And I'm trying to explain to people, no, they do not. The initial act of aggression is violence, and the return act of using enough defensive force to repel that attack, that initiation of violence, is simply the usage of force in a moral capacity.
Now, when we talk about force in terms of a use of moral capacity, one thing that was occurring to me, or I was thinking about it just before coming on the show today, is about communists, like socialists in New Zealand, who go out and accuse people of being racist. You're racist, you can't say that. You're racist, you can't do this. And I was just thinking, how far does that go? And how ironic is it that you've got a fascist calling somebody a racist?
Right.
Because they're trying to control what you can say, what you can do, what you can think. I mean, I'm not racist, but I think that I'm wondering, should I fight for people's right to be wrong, you know? Or should, because what I find is happening is that it's not an actual education campaign about being why racism is wrong. It's simply racism is wrong, thought crime.
Right. You know, I think a lot of this is coming under the banner of trying to shut down a speech that goes in opposition to the status quo and goes in opposition to the control system. You know, they're trying to make dissenting speech a crime overall. And one of the best ways that they're going about doing it, the best manipulative tactic that they're using, is to try to equate this with absolute violent extremism and or racism, when obviously nothing can be further from the truth. Not saying there may not be people who are like that in any community, but the truth community is not advocating any of those things. What most of the alternative researchers and alternative research community are advocating is simply to end human slavery and to truly move into a period of true human freedom by eliminating this control system, getting rid of it as a system that doesn't serve humanity, it doesn't serve who we are whatsoever. The people who want to cling on to these old and outdated and outmoded belief systems of authority and control and government, etc., and monetary systems, these people are going to use any ad hominem attack that they feel is required or that they think will get people onto their side and see their opposition as violent extremists or as racists or homophobes words or whatever other things that they want to concoct and say about the people who are really speaking out against these immoral institutions that are clinging on for dear life in the modern day. But really, we know what the truth is, and the truth is that we're just telling it like it really is, even if it may offend some people who are, again, believers in the slavery system. See, that's what I've been really trying to just stop using euphemisms and say how it really is in reality. So, you know, I don't even want to call people statists anymore or call them, you know, believers in government. What they are supporters of slavery. That's what people have to recognize, that anyone who believes in government is. They support the concept that this imaginary thing called authority exists and is vested in certain individuals or groups of individuals, and they are masters who have a moral right to issue commands when all other people are their subjects who have a moral obligation to obey their commands. This is an illusory concept that does not exist in nature. It doesn't exist in reality. And what it really is slavery, if we're not euphemizing and trying to give it a nice name and calling it authority or government. It is human slavery, if we're being honest with ourselves. So that's kind of, you know, what I see them just trying to do. Anybody who's truly talking out in opposition to slavery, they have to paint as a extremist or a quote racist. It's a very, very desperate tactic that they're using, and I think many people are really seeing through it, and it's not going to be working as effectively as more and more people wake up and come online in consciousness.
Let's hope so. There's a concept out there that I've been looking at more recently, is that people don't want to be slaves, yet they're addicted to it, much like a drug or alcohol. Sure. Or something of that nature. It's an addiction. And before you can give up an addiction, you have to stop living in denial. I don't have
That's
a problem.
Right.
Slavery doesn't exist. But it does. You are drinking too much slavery from that cup. you know? Put it down, mate. Okay?
Sure.
Stop drinking that slavery juice.
Absolutely. And, you know, this is a psychological dynamic that many people have a really hard time breaking out of, because it's a fear-based reaction. People fear the unknown. And this is all they have ever known. This system of slavery is all they have ever known. So to move into something, into an uncharted territory, is an often frightening thing for many people. And, you know, they loathe going there because, you know, nobody's going to be telling you exactly how it has to be. You're going to be inventing that and creating it as you go in a world of true freedom. And that carries with it responsibility, which is another thing people shun and don't want. You know, I'll give you a little anecdotal story in my life and, you know, make this a little bit personal. I'll tell you a story of some interactions that happened between myself and my mother a few years back. And this goes along with, you know, the idea of comfort levels and not wanting to go into uncharted territory and having no other framework or having nothing else to, quote, cling on to or, quote, believe in, and therefore wanting to stay in that comfort zone. When years ago, when I really began to study astrotheology and understand how modern religions were based upon the astrotheological, you know, underpinnings of religion, and how that was the esoteric aspect that was really kind of actually there to keep the core truths, like you talked about earlier, that are at the seed. They're the actual life core at the center of all major cultural religions and mystery tradition teachings, etc. There is that core of truth that lies there. Then there's this esoteric cover story that is the astrotheological teachings that are kind of allegorical, that they allegorically veil these core spiritual truths. Then around that you have the exoteric literal interpretations that are given to the masses and, you know, just get them to comply and fall in line. So, you know, my family has always, of course, other members of my family have always been in that that outer shell, that exoteric, you know, following along, you know, this is what my parents taught me, because, and that's what their parents taught them, and so we go along in line. That's how my family has always been. They're not the types to question and to, you know, seek real answers. It's more comfortable just accepting things and just believing it because you're told to believe it, and that's it, and there, you don't rock the boat. You know, I really had this drive and push since the time I was young, this desire to break away from that and ask questions and challenge things and ask that dangerous question, why, you know, that many people don't want to ask. But when I started really deeply studying astrotheology and understanding it, I wanted to bring this knowledge to some of my family members. So I would engage them in conversation dealing with different religious concepts that had clear parallels to astrotheology. So I could explain to them, hey, you know, Christianity, it's a religion that's all about the sun and the worship of the sun. And it's just putting solar symbolism everywhere. And, you know, it's the story of the sun on the cross of the zodiac. Like you have the story of God's son on the cross. And it's just an allegory. And there's powerful information in that allegory. And it doesn't discount the very core underpinning spiritual truths that lie at the heart of that religion, but you have to really break past these literal interpretations and allegories to see those spiritual truths. So over a period of like about a month, I kept bringing different astrotheological teachings and understandings and explaining allegories to my mother in a pretty forceful way, I will just say. You know, in a way that, you know, was relentless, to a point where borderline people would say, you are forcing this upon this individual. Admittedly, I did that. In a lot of ways, I see it was pretty forceful, and in other ways, I'm not apologetic for it. But she understood it. I kept going back and back and back and hammering the information into this person as best as I could until I felt they had somewhat of an understanding of these parallels regarding this religion that they subscribe to. After that, maybe about a month or two after that, I saw her returning from church. And I said, you know, I told you what that whole thing is all about. And you still attend, and you know, you still go to church and believe in it all. And she said, well, it's not the same now. And I said, well, how so? And she said, I see that everything you were saying is true. I recognize that this is what you're saying that it is, you know, and teaching me about, called astrotheology. And I see all the symbolism. When I go into church, I see all the symbolism that you were talking about, and it's undeniable. I cannot tell you that you are wrong about what you're saying about this. However, I have nothing else. What else is there for me? There's nothing else for me to believe in. So therefore, this is what gives me comfort, and therefore I still go. But she said it's different now because I can't get the same level of comfort. You've ruined that for me. Actually said that to me.
You bastard.
I've ruined the illusion of comfort that was derived from going into this church and believing in this religion and accepting their teachings like blindly without actually questioning it or looking into it analytically or looking at what the origins of it are or the you know, allegorical underpinnings of it are. But, you know, basically recognizing what I was saying is true. And that has kind of ruined the experience for her because, you know, she can actually see the solar symbolism that I talked about over that month. But the answer was, what else do I have? What else is there? What else is there for me to believe in and latch on to and, you know, use as a crutch, so to speak? That's where people's mindset is at.
You're right. And I was just thinking about that in terms of addiction. It's like somebody smoking really, really bad, low-quality weed all their life kind of thing, and then somebody brings along some really, really strong hydroponic stuff, and they smoke some of them, and they're like, whoa, 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 what have I been missing out on, man? And all of a sudden, all that weed that you've been smoking your entire life is just no longer good enough. You want this, except there's no supply. So you've kind of been shown the top of the mountain, but you haven't reached the promised land.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. They see in many ways that what they're being told is a lie, but to create something on their own, or to go into the what I would just call the realm of true spiritual or cosmic adulthood, you know, psychological and spiritual adulthood, emotional adulthood, is too painful. Again, part of it is because this is the only thing they've ever known, and that's a form of addiction. You get so used to it, you get so hooked on it, that when somebody cuts that cord or breaks that chain, they stay there as if it's still attached and say, what else am I supposed to do? And the answer to that is, it's think for yourself, ask questions, understand causal factors about why things are the way that they are. You know, really, it's called accepting personal responsibility and becoming a true adult, leaving the realm of spiritual infancy. And that means taking on personal responsibility to truth. And again, that's something just many people want to refuse. They don't want it. They want to stay in that childhood, in that form of spiritual infancy.
Mm-hmm. Now, in this term of this form of spiritual infancy, I think a lot of us are going through this. Now, when people are at that point, when you ask yourself, what am I supposed to do now? They treat it as a rhetorical question. A question that does not need an answer. And the problem is, that's a wrong way to go about it.
Look,
if you're going to ask a very important, introspective question that has real consequences for your life and maybe the lives of your families, perhaps even the lives of everybody on this world, why would you not go about seeking the answers to that question?
Yes. Practical answers in ways that can actually be applied in the real world, in real life. And when people ask me that question, where do I start? I give them a simple, you know, formula. This is about cleaning up and growing up. Okay? We've put so many pollutants into ourselves, and the pollutants are just constantly reinforced. They're constantly pumped into us on a daily basis. It needs continuous application. The poison has to be continuously applied. Okay? So the first real thing to understand is we have an adulterated condition. I won't use the word adulterated nature. This isn't our nature. How humanity is existing today is not human nature. This is a big fallacy and something that a lot of people get completely wrong because they've been fed that worldview that people are just bad and this is just how humanity is. I don't accept that. I don't see this as human nature. This is the human condition that many people are working hard to change the conditions, because we know that as if we change the condition, we are ultimately going to change the level of consciousness. Okay? They go hand in hand with each other. Yes.
It's not entirely dissimilar from how when you study something, you also change it. The Heisenberg uncertainty principle.
Right.
What was I saying before? Oh, yeah. Perception and reality. I came up with a concept like this. Reality is a lump of clay. Perception is the hands of the artisan that can mold it into a vase. A vase whose form could not have taken shape without the hands of the artisan, and a form which could not exist without the clay. It is not one nor is it the other. It is both intertwined like a together. double helix,
right.
and it kind of rolls over and twists and turns and everything, and there are blurred lines and what have you. But the thing is, both of those lines are always there together, working in harmony. And you're right when you say about this this left brain, right brain paradigm, is that what they're trying to do is split reality from perception and tell people that these are separate, kind of like how you would kidnap a child from its mother at the before the age of 7 as a Jesuit so that you can brainwash that child.
Absolutely. Very profound that these dynamics work hand in hand together. And, you know, while perception isn't reality, and I tell people that what our goal is to align the two, you know, it's about bringing our perception closer into the realm of truth so that it doesn't waver and sway off of truth. And then we're living in harmony with that. And therefore, we're going to create things that are good systems, that are systems which truly serve who we are and where we say we want to go. But if we're in that form of opposition, like you said, they want to always create these opposition, you know, this divide and conquer strategy. And the biggest thing is they want to create internal opposition within us such that, you know, we aren't acting the way that we say we think and the way that we say we feel. If we're in that kind of internal contradiction and opposition, we can't possibly be creating something that's truly good for us. We can't possibly be creating and going in the direction that we say we want to go, because that opposition is always going to take us down a path that we don't want to go. And actually, that's a good learning experience. That form of chaos, that natural form of chaos that happens as a result of doing something the wrong way, but being able to have the freedom to do it the wrong way and learn from that, okay, is healthy. It's like, you know, when you a child touches something, a flame or a really hot surface, and they get burned, they know it's probably a good idea, if you see a flame or a hot surface again, not to touch it, to repeat the same painful experience. Unfortunately, what's happening in our society is we're becoming the child that doesn't get the connection between touching the hot surface and getting the second or third degree burn on their hand, because our society is trying to completely sanitize reality from anything that can possibly do harm to somebody and anything that could possibly, you know, show somebody this is definitely not the right way to go about doing this. We want to sanitize things down to the level of a child. And see, it all comes back down to that. It all comes back down to this notion that what humanity is in a state of infancy that has been kept in that state of spiritual infancy, in this state of spiritual childhood. And they want to continue that state. Again, this is, much of my future work is going to be addressing these questions more deeply and looking at it from a perspective of abandonment issues. Abandonment issues, I feel, are at the root of all of the psychological issues that people are experiencing. It's why we don't want to truly take on personal responsibility. It's why humanity has a lot of issues with self-loathing and the lack of self-respect. Many people feel, you know, we are deserving of the current human condition. You know, that's why they don't even feel that they should try to change it. That, oh, this is just how people are. They're bad. We deserve this. And what can you do anyway? And so why bother to take up an empowered position and actually try to use your will to change it? You're just going to get disappointment on the other end anyway, because you're not going to be able to do that. And anyway, we probably deserve this. It's such a dark and poisoned worldview, and so many people have that worldview. You know, it's like an addict, a drug addict, a really bad drug addict who's like, you know, has ruined their life because of their addiction. And, you know, they've fallen into that mentality of shame, where they feel, I've done such a bad thing to myself that I don't even deserve to come out of this, so why should I even bother trying? This is where I belong. That's how much of humanity feels about the current human condition of slavery. And again, my thesis on this is that's because we have low self-esteem and lack of self-respect. There's a lot of self-loathing going on in the current human condition, and that in turn is driven by parental abandonment issues on not only a personal scale as far as in individuals' actual lives, but I see it as something that's embedded in our ancestral memory because of a lot of events that happened in the ancient human past as well.
I was thinking it was more of a recent effect, specifically inside the truth movement. I think that when you learn this information, when you learn everything that you've been brought up to believe is a lie, you suffer trauma. And I think that almost all of us are suffering a form of post-traumatic stress disorder.
Sure.
And that occasionally you have episodes, you break out, you get enraged or depressed or these other psychological issues simply because what you were told was reality turned out to be a lie. And so you have to build your whole life from scratch. It's like seeing your house burn down in front of you, except it's the house that you've built inside your own mind about who
That's
you
right.
are and how you view the world. It's like losing your mother, you know, kind of thing. Your whole world falls apart. And I don't think you ever get over that kind of trauma.
Exactly. I've called this ego identification, attachment to the roles that we have played in life, or even worldview identification would be a great term to call it, because it's attachment to a specific way of seeing reality that has been embedded and really deeply nested in the individual's personality. That can be a very, 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 very difficult hole to dig yourself out of, because again, it's uncharted waters. It's uncharted territory. And if you haven't, you know, worked those muscles psychologically, mentally, emotionally, it's like trying to, you know, throw a heavy barbell at somebody who's, you know, their muscles have been atrophied for years and they've been inactive and, you know, complacent and, you know, living a sedentary lifestyle, and they, you know, don't have the strength to do that heavy lifting. It has to be done kind of piecemeal. But I don't think we need to sugarcoat it or patronize people. I think we still need to tell people that that work does need to be done. There isn't an obligation to do that kind of psychological work if we're going to come out of this horrible condition that is really advocating immoral behavior. And that's where we've come into. We've come into a place where humanity as a whole is advocating so much immoral behavior in the name of the state, in the name of government, again, because it's the only system they've ever known, and they don't want the responsibility that comes with taking down an institution that does not serve where we say we want to go, and then having to take on the responsibility to, you know, on the fly, create something new that does serve where we want to go.
You're right. Or not
even create something new isn't even the term, really, Vinny. It's really just acknowledging
what's
already there. What's already there and healing. Yes, absolutely. Doing that work to heal the self. That's not just an automatic process either, as some people who are kind of naive want to think that it is. That takes hard work, time, and effort to do, and a lot of people don't want to invest that time.
And often they're often way too tired because they've got a slave job. And I was thinking about nature, and how does nature give you a poison and a cure at the same time? Because that's what this information is to a large extent. It's actually quite toxic to behold, because often when people are given the negative side of the New World Order, the eugenics programs and what have you, they're not packaging it. Like fruit, for example, fructose can't actually be digested by the body properly. And that's why we got all this problem with obesity in America, with all the high fructose corn syrup that's in absolutely everything. When nature gives you fructose, it packages it with fiber in the fruit. That way it neutralizes it and allows the body to process it. Think about this on a psychological side of things, where here's the truth, it's the fructose, it's good for you, it's got energy and what have you, but unless you've actually got that wonderful fibrous thing called reality behind it, solutions, and having the ability to just deal with this crap that you're feeding yourself.
All right.
Unless you've got both of those things together, you just wind up going to get poisoned and obese in the sense of the word, which means, in a psychological sense, a very unhealthy fathead.
And this dovetails right back into what we were talking about before, solutions. When people ask you, what can I do? What else is there? Practically, what can you do? And they ask that question again. I talk about the idea of it's just a matter of purification. It's getting off of the poison and adding the good stuff that is nutritious. So and this is done on all levels. This has to be done on a physical level first and foremost, which is why many of the people who haven't even begun this journey or this trek or this transformation or whatever you want to call it, this process, and they ask the question, what can I do? I try to explain the first thing to do is to clean up the diet. The physical body has to be cleaned up to the extent that is within your capability, within your power, within your ability to do so. And I think we still largely do maintain it, to a large extent, the ability to do that on our own. Because to my knowledge, nobody is actually forcibly making people eat specific things. They might be influencing their decisions to do that with certain types of marketing and the proclivity of certain types of items on food shelves. But ultimately, it's our decision in the end what we pick up and put in our own mouths. So the physical nutritional aspect of this is one of the first things, and cleaning up the diet and getting off of a lot of these processed foods and high fructose corn syrup and other excitotoxins in the diet. That goes hand in hand with emotional and psychological cleanup. Michael Tessarion, a brilliant researcher who I have a lot of respect for, has often talked about the parallels between the words sanitize and sanity. To become sane, to make someone, to make yourself sane from an insane condition, you're taking yourself from a non-sanitized condition, an unclean and non-purified condition, and sanitizing your mental health, sanitizing your psychological framework. So you're actually doing purification and taking, negative and polluting ideas out of the mind to make it more pure. All of these three things go hand in hand, the physical level, the emotional level, and the psychological level. And when we put those three things together, what we're really doing is cleaning up on the entire spiritual scale. Mm-hmm. And that's really what the goal is. It's to go through that process of spiritual purification and transformation. Again, if we're going to end the system of slavery and build something positive that is truly beneficial to humanity on the other side of that great change.
Yeah, we've got to achieve a form of, I guess it's congruence, swimming together, and balance, right? This is that one concept that is seemed to be thrown right out the window when you look at politics, government, and what have you. They say, oh, well, a balance to an evil left paradigm is an evil right paradigm. No, that's right. That's way over balancing it even more into the evil side, bro. That's not cool, man. And the difficulty is that they don't even realize that they're even doing anything wrong because they right. think they actually believe yep. that they're morally in the right.
Right. Because they've bought into this notion of opposites in the same system. I like the concept of the researcher David Icke. He calls these opposames. I love that term because it's like you're saying, voting for the lesser of two evils is still bringing evil into the world. You're just adding more of that polar dynamic. You're not, changing the dynamic. You're not adding the opposite polar dynamic. This is where these dichotomies come into play, these dialectics that are false choices. It's a brilliant mind control strategy from the perspective of, those who are using it against us. You have to almost have some respect for it as, tactics being employed by the opposition. But when it comes down to it, all this is a simple divide and conquer strategy that we need to see. It's the same thing on both sides. There is no left-right. That paradigm is an illusion. There is no, it's either I need to put my faith in the conservative or I need to put my faith in the liberal. They're all the same thing to get us to go in the same direction, which is more control and ultimately continuing to accept the notion of authority, which is the thing that I keep bringing up, because that's the thing that lies underneath all of this, the concept that there's, you know, this thing called authority, and it exists and it is vested in man, is really the religion that has to be ultimately broken down and done away with. And again, that's something that, since people have been living so long with that addiction, they think that's the solution to everything, is to vest power in certain people and give them a monopoly on violence to go out and allegedly solve problems, when that doesn't solve anything. You know, we're addicted to that. And the uncharted territory that we fear stepping out into is, well, what can we do without that addiction there? How could it be different? Of course, there's a myriad version of solutions that are voluntary that could be enacted, but it would require a fundamental shift in perception and a fundamental detachment from things that we have been psychologically and emotionally attached to for far too long.
Now, if we think about this in terms of getting off an addiction, what people often do is they'll replace it with another drug. Okay, I want to stop. Right. I want to stop smoking cigarettes, so I'll start smoking weed. I want to stop drinking alcohol, so I'll start taking ecstasy. I want to stop taking ecstasy, so I'll start taking mescaline. I want to stop taking mescaline, so I'll start taking ayahuasca. I want to stop taking ayahuasca, so I'll you know, it just goes on and on and on. There are infinite authorities, infinite religions, because there are infinite scumbags willing to take advantage of weak-minded, disempowered people for their own advantage.
And keep them in that state of psychological infancy, it's so dependence. They never claim... Yes, that's exactly what it is. Never stepping out in an independent sense, claiming your own power and personal responsibility. And again, it's because this muscle has not been used. It has been atrophied. And like you said, it's trading one form of slavery for another. If we hop to the next religion or the next form of authority or the next form of government or the next monetary system, it's not actually taking down the barrier that has been blocking us from the truth, the natural world, the natural system that has already been here, that gives us all the guidelines that we really need to understand. And I've grouped that under the umbrella, of course, the umbrella term natural law. This is what all of these systems are designed to hold us back from a fundamental understanding of, because only a fundamental understanding of natural law can ever liberate our species and bring true freedom to us. And without that understanding, we're going to keep doing what you just described very eloquently, replacing one addiction for another addiction, one set of chains for another set of chains. This is why in so many revolutions that have happened in the past, physical armed rebellions, a new form of dictatorship or a new form of oppression has always come in and very quickly right afterward. So, you know, if we're going to avoid that scenario when this system eventually breaks down and crumbles, which it needs to do, we need to prepare that psychologically, and we need to be in positions where we're going to be able to reach out to people in an effective way with certain skill sets and communication capabilities, I can't stress the importance of being able to clearly communicate with people and illustrate concepts in ways that they can make sense of.
It's a form of psychological articulation kung fu to a degree,
sure.
You know, sort of like a monk will practice his stretches and what have you,
sure,
for decades, and then eventually he's like the ultimate master and what have you. And I think that's really what we're doing to a large degree, is we are creating a new religion to a degree that is a complete antithesis to what religion actually is. It's something that you can believe in, but not something that's illusionary, that we're just telling you to believe in so that we can have power over you. We're showing you what the facts are so that you can work things out for yourself, so that you don't get duped by other religions again.
Right.
And I'm not saying that all religions are bad. There are many, many Christians that I've met who are absolutely onto it. Best people that you'll ever meet, very logical, very reasonable. They know about the New World Order, they know about the occult, and yet they still believe in moral obligations to do good. And that's inherently what they do their entire life. I got no argument with that kind of use of religion,
sure,
whatsoever.
Sure.
The positive use of religion is not lying in what you're allowed to do, but it lies within what you are restrained from doing by your beliefs. Right.
In other words, it is apophatic. It takes natural law into account by saying what actions, to understand the actions that I may morally perform, I need to understand the actions that I may not morally perform, that are immoral to perform. Okay, so it's an apophatic way of looking at natural law. It's defining what a right is by understanding truly what a wrong is, what is wrongdoing, what are actions that cause suffering to others, and then choosing willfully not to do those things, and therefore you're only engaging in behaviors that are moral rights. I like your idea that this is a religion from a positive sense or a positive connotation or definition of the word. There's really two different definitions of the word religion. I've often used religion in my teachings from the Latin verb religare, which is where it comes from etymologically to us out of Latin, the English word
religion. To hold the mind back or something?
Well, religare simply means to tie back or to bind, to hold back or to thwart from forward progress in anything. Okay, so in other words, they would maybe the Romans would have used the word religare to describe tying a steed to a post. Okay, you have bound him there so he cannot move forward or move away from that point. It's stopping the forward motion or the forward progression. So that's a form of tying up or binding or holding there, holding in place. That's what a false religion does. And all the false religions of the world are money, authority, scientism, politics, government. I'm not talking about real, true science that goes where the evidence leads. I'm talking about, you know, science that is all based in funding and money and, you know, status. Yeah, exactly. You know, that's all about just social status and who has tenure at a university and who's written the top books on a topic. And so anything new evidence that comes along that may contradict that has to be buried and suppressed. That I call that scientism. And of course, the New Age movement is one of these religions. Now, I would group some of the cultural religions in with that, although I would say at the very core, if you strip away all the exoteric junk and astrotheological underpinnings, you do have a deep esoteric core there that is true spirituality. But it's so muddied; those waters are so muddied and so buried with the allegories and with the exoteric stuff that's there to keep the people from those core truths. That I almost say they you know, I don't even want to just say completely abandon all of that, but it definitely needs to be looked at in a new light and say, you know, you need to realize you have to go beyond this. This might be a stepping stone to go to where you're at because it does, they do all in their own way teach moral behavior. But it's what many people have likened to, you know, reaching, you know, not quite the apex of the mountain. You're high on the mountain, but you're not up at the very tip top at the apex, which is where we really need to go, which is truth becoming our religion, okay, and going wherever the evidence leads us, regardless of what you have to, you know, cut away, regardless of what you have to release attachment from in that process of making that climb. So in the positive sense, right, the word religare did not just mean to tie up and bind and thwart from forward progress, which is what I would categorize a false religion as. But in a positive sense, I would look at a true religion as the other definition of religare in Latin was to reunite, to bring back together something that had been scattered. Something that had been broken apart or dismembered, you're gathering those pieces and you're bringing them back together as a whole. And this is what we need to do with ourselves, with our psyche, which is scattered and traumatized and broken in a million pieces and shards. You know, we need to gather ourselves and remember who we are and remember from dismemberment, bring ourselves back together, bring the elements of our consciousness back into non-contradiction, into unity consciousness, such that that we are a being that as we think, so we feel, and so we act, and there's no contradiction between those three modalities of consciousness. In that sense, we would be practicing true religion, which is to reunite ourselves with the truth. So that's why I kind of like the idea of what you're saying. What we're ultimately trying to bring into fruition and bring onto the world stage is a new religion, in a sense, from the positive interpretation or the positive etymological definition of that word, to reunite. And what we're reuniting ourselves and hopefully other people with is the truth about what's going on here on this planet, and the truth about how we need to align ourselves with natural law if we're going to really create a world that's worth living in.
Mm-hmm. And I also think, and we'll go to a break just in a second here, Mark. I just want to get the statement out. The word religare, to hold back, to tie you in place or whatever, I think that is one of actually the best parts about religion. There's certain things that you're not allowed to do. You're not allowed to hurt people. You're not allowed to kill people. You're not allowed to steal their stuff and what have you. And these are the basic things that, again, I just wanted to reiterate, and I've already said it, but I think it bears repeating. You've got to be able to restrain yourself from doing bad things if you want to truly do a good thing.
That's right. And that's that positive connotation of even what can be seen as negative, to hold back or thwart from forward progress. If you're using these principles of natural law to hold yourself back from doing harm to other people,
not hold
then
others
that becomes
back,
very,
but hold
right,
yourself.
It has to be practiced internally by an act of your own will. Then I would say it becomes a very positive connotation, and that's religion in the true sense. Absolutely. Great point.
Indeed. Mark Passio from whatonearthishappening.com is my very special guest, and we'll be back in just a few moments for the second hour.
Pass me so fast, I don't think I'll catch up with it. A politician selling me out of my country. I've got an inkling that don't care about me in the summer. In the city when those girls are so pretty, they distract me from all the important things as I get sold quietly into slavery in the summer. Yeah, in the city where the girls are so pretty.
And we're back, ladies and gentlemen. You're now listening to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, the lighter side of genocide, because in a world so full of chaos and madness, if you do lose that sense of humour, you will go friggin' nuts. Now, coping mechanisms, these are something that I was talking about earlier in terms of theorising that the truth movement in general is suffering from a form of... post-traumatic stress disorder. And when dealing with any trauma, there are many, many coping techniques that people will often undertake. Some of them are inherently healthy, others are inherently damaging to your health, right? Now, I feel that laughter in the face of scumbaggery, much like Doctor Who, is a good thing. It's a good, healthy response. Just like the reason why somebody can accuse another radio host or something of that nature, of working for the Mossad, and that person will suddenly crack up laughing, "I work for the Mossad!" Perfect response, because there's nothing you can actually argue against somebody accusing you of something that's not true,
right?
That they can't prove.
Proving a negative,
just to laugh at them, because it's just so insane. Mark Passio is my very special guest. What on earth is happening? .com is the website, and as I mentioned when I introduced you in the first segment, some of your research, and I just want to thank you for your articulate nature, because I believe that both myself and tens of thousands of others would not actually be wise to many, many concepts that are currently affecting our lives if not for your ability to explain it in a way that we can comprehend it, Mark. And I just want to thank you on behalf of these tens of thousands, maybe even hundreds of thousands, maybe even millions of people out there that have actually had their lives and their ability to think literally changed by your taking personal responsibility for categorizing and explaining clearly and unemotionally these topics, which are so important to humanity today. Thank you.
Well, I respectfully will accept that as a high compliment. I want to thank you and tell you that I appreciate that. I do feel that's one of my strong points is my communications capabilities and being able to explain some seemingly complex and possibly what are seen as non-interrelated topics and bringing them together in a framework or a tapestry through which they can make much more sense to people. As very, very connected, inextricably connected, and needing to be seen as such if we're really going to understand what's going on in the world all around us. So that's something, you know, I do take pride in that capability. I feel like it's definitely a forte of mine. And that's what I really said from day one that I was going to be trying to do when I stepped into this field is really paint the tapestry in people's minds. That's why I tell people it's so important. You can't hear one of the interviews that I do in isolation. You can't listen in for 5 minutes on a YouTube video or, you know, check out a video that I've done with another radio show host and just say, well, I know everything that this guy's talking about. You really need to take my advice and go to my webpage and check out the podcast in progression, in sequence. I think many people who have done that have probably gleaned and the most and benefited the most from that tapestry, because that's where it is slowly unfurled. And you get to see all the different aspects of it. And if you do it at your own pace, and at your own leisure, when you have time to, and you know, you move through it without skipping ahead and do it in progression, it's very deliberately laid out as in a specific sequential order, such that other worldview starts to open up and the big picture really makes sense. So that was definitely deliberately designed as such, and I'm glad to hear you say that you feel that it came across very effectively.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of like using an inverted Freemasonry model, where instead of occulting the knowledge and then making people pass certain levels before they can get access to the other knowledge, you give people all access to the knowledge so that they can accumulate it for themselves, not to open them up to a level of being corruptible or open for demon possession, as some people have theorized, but indeed to open you up to your own spiritual awareness, your own
and potential. And that's why I like to call myself a de-occultist. You know, people will say, well, I'm an occultist. I study the occult, and you know, I learn these teachings and, you know, live by some of these teachings, but I don't like to even call myself an occultist. I prefer the term de-occultist, which means taking things out of hiding and distributing them widely and freely, such as to attempt to level the playing field, because the playing field is not level when there is a differential in knowledge, when one group has a tremendous amount of knowledge and they're holding it over people's heads. You know, that creates a tremendous power differential. So if we're going to level the power differential and bring it to balance, we have to level the knowledge differential by distributing knowledge openly and freely, and that's what I've attempted to do with my website and all the information that I put out.
Can I give a New Zealand example? Because you're talking about knowledge, and when I think about knowledge and one culture having more knowledge than another, I think about technological advancements that allow that other person to enslave that other culture. You come in with muskets and you're up against bows and arrows, you're going to kill everybody who's got a bow and arrow pretty easily, right?
Sure.
Okay.
Sure.
And just think about this. That's the level of technology. I mean, comparatively speaking, what the general public has access to in terms of weaponry for the purposes of self-defense versus what the establishment armies have access to is far out of kilter.
Sure.
That's a really dangerous position, because what we're talking about here is, and I think somebody mentioned this to me last night, Mark, and I want to get your opinion on it.
Sure.
we're merely slaves on the plantation, right?
Right.
This is it. And I wanted to, you know, grab my megaphone and just go out to a crowd and everything like that and speak to them. And I go, friends, countrymen, fellow slaves of the plantation, welcome. Right. Thank you for being here. I would love to be referred to as a slave of the plantation. It'd be great.
It's sad but true. And, you know, that's really what I – whenever people who don't really know what I do or what I'm into and they ask, well, what's your website about, I no longer try to say, hey, it's about consciousness and all of its aspects and understanding how consciousness works. It's about, you know, how we are creating the reality that we're experiencing through our thoughts, emotions, and actions, you know, how, you know, there's a police state all around us and many people can't see it. And, you know, I don't even get into or tell them, oh, I teach occultism and symbolism and astrotheology. I don't even get into trying to explain all these different aspects of what I talk about. What I tell people that I do or what I tell people that my website is about is I simply say it's about slavery and how to end it once and for all. And I just say I'm completely against all slavery in all of its forms. And what the information on the site is trying to do is show you that we're in the current human condition is a state of slavery. And the website and myself advocate for the end of that condition, which is an immoral condition for humanity to continue to exist in. So that's what I tell people that what I do is about. I am an anti-slavery activist. You could call me a de-occultist who tries to take hidden knowledge, which is what the occult is, and bring it to people in open capacity, in an open source type of format. That's one label I would accept willingly as a de-occultist. But I also like to refer to myself as an anti-slavery activist, and I think that's what people really need to unify on. What we're really trying to do in the truth movement and the freedom community is end slavery once and for all on planet Earth.
Now, it's interesting you should say that, because it occurred to me, I've been to hundreds of protests, Mark, on all sorts of topics. The one signs that I don't see are signs that have the words slavery on them. Nobody's protesting slavery because they don't even realize that they're slaves.
That they're in it, yeah.
Because the knowledge of your slavery has been occulted, all right?
Right.
So,
right.
Hence, if we're talking about human race, okay, and versus, and maybe it's dualistic, maybe it's not, the human race, the free human race, with all our potential, all our beauty, all of our intricacies. Then over here, we have, let's say, an inhuman entity. Whether they're actually human and they just act like real douchebags, or they're off some kind of off-planet scumbaggery, who cares? Point is, the effect of them doing what they're doing to us, the free human race, is the same in any language and the same
That's
in
right.
any universe.
That's
Therefore,
right.
there has to be a universal resistance. And I think
right.
that this concept that you've touched upon here indeed may be the key, is simply recognizing, not fearing, not feeling defeated by, but just recognizing the simple, obvious fact that we're not actually free. We are currently slaves. We have slave masters who at any point they wish they can mess our life up real good and real fast and real heavy.
So, yeah, many different aspects were brought up here. The very enormous differential, not only in the knowledge that a lot of the slave masters, if you will, the people who are currently in control of this planet, hold over the ignorant masses of humanity, you know, and that's because, again, the knowledge of the occult is twofold. When you say that, again, it brings up a lot of connotations in people's minds. Many people still don't know what the word occult means. I gave a presentation here in Philadelphia last night, locally, and I asked people how many people were expecting to hear about the occult or knew about what the occult really is, and like 90% of people raised their hand. Now, obviously, they were coming to hear me speak, so they probably knew about my work previously, of course, so that's a skewed number. but it's really good to see that this word is starting to be really understood more and more by people, and the negative connotations are being released and let go of, and people are really understanding what it truly means. It means hidden. That's all. Occult comes from the Latin adjective occultus, and that in turn comes from the Latin verb occultare. Occultus means hidden, and occultare means to hide or to conceal or to keep secret, to keep away from someone's sight so that they're not able to see it or understand it. That's all occult. The occult is, it's hidden knowledge. Now, what constitutes that body of knowledge? Well, there's two aspects of occult knowledge. The first is called the minor or lesser knowledge, not to mean it's any less important, but it is the knowledge of the microcosm, the small things, or in other words, the individuated units of consciousness, meaning the people. It's the knowledge about how a human being works, or any real being. It's knowledge about how thought within an individuated consciousness in the form of a being like you or me works, okay? So if we understand those aspects of consciousness, we're studying the psyche. We are studying the soul within the individual. We're studying the personality. We're studying what drives them, what makes them tick, their fears, their inhibitions, you know, their desires, etc. That's psychology. By any other name you want to call it, it's the study of the psyche. Okay, so that's what's called the lesser of these two forms of knowledge. Then there's greater knowledge, or what has been termed in occult schools of thought, the knowledge of the macrocosm. The knowledge of the macrocosm is how the universal laws of nature function and work, and how they actually interoperate with our free will decisions and our behaviors to help to bring the results of how we behave to us, so that we have to experience that and learn from it and grow as a result of making those behavioral decisions. That's the knowledge that I've called natural law. So it's the knowledge of psychology combined with the knowledge of natural law. Now think about how powerful just those two bodies of knowledge is, how empowering those two bodies of knowledge, if they are understood, become.
So I know how the world works, and I know how people think. Like, not just being arrogant about it, but actually knowing, that is such a powerful individual. You know, that's like almost godlike power.
You know, I wouldn't liken it to godlike power, because I would say that's the ability to make those laws. But you could say in the absence of that knowledge, one could be seen like a god, if someone were so ignorant that they had never undertaken any aspect of any of those studies and knew none of it. Imagine the differential in power. It would seem like down here you would have this little lesser being, and up here you would have this godlike being that knew everything about how everything works. Mm. When in fact, this is just simple science and simple understanding of how fundamental systems work, including the yes,
and this analogy also goes back to that the ancient astronaut theories and what have you. If theoretically some race did come to Earth long ago in spaceships and whatnot, wouldn't they be the gods from the heavens?
Well, it's funny you should mention that, because this is exactly what my talk in Philadelphia was about last night. I really came forward and talked about a lot of things. I don't know if I want to start to unpack this here today in this interview. I'd like to keep it toward the occult side of things and the psychological side of things. But I'll give you a little teaser. The video will be online soon. It will be on my website and YouTube channel. It was recorded. It was recorded from multiple angles. We're going to try to do some nice video editing and get the slides in there and everything and put out a nice video. But I did get into this very hypothesis theory, if you will, or I call it simply an explanatory synthesis, that if we did have interactions with off-world beings that was very traumatic in our past, this could very much explain and account for many aspects of the current human conditions, and also explain why we have certain institutions in place the way that they're in place in the modern world. That's what my talk last night was actually about. It was given as I was invited by a fellow researcher in the Philadelphia area, Chris Augustine. He runs a local group here in Philadelphia. It's called the Philadelphia UFO Meetup Group. And he invited me to speak, and he said, is there any topic you really want to, you know, talk about that maybe you've been tight-lipped about in the past or have been reluctant to talk about because you haven't unpacked all of the other information you wanted to get to before, you know, in other words, preparing the way and leading up to talking about, you know, a topic that you that may people may be you know, skeptical about hearing about, but you know, if you pave the way enough, then maybe now is the right time. And I said, yeah, there is a lot of stuff that I'm going to start talking about and covering in that field, and I feel that the time is now to do that. So last night was probably, you know, I laid it all out on the table in the presentation that I gave here in Philadelphia, and that will be available soon. But it touches on this very concept that you were talking about. If we look at a differential in knowledge, as, you know, I believe it was Arthur C. Clarke who once said, any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from the supernatural or from magic. Okay. A being with lesser amount of knowledge regarding technology or regarding how the universal laws of nature work would see another being who had that knowledge in their possession and was able to wield it seemingly at their will, okay, as a god. And I do feel that is more likely than not what did occur in our ancient past when we had interactions with beings that were are not indigenous to the earth, or what you would call simply extraterrestrial.
May I provide an even more modern example? I think it was even in 1962, I believe, a couple of researchers and explorers in Papua New Guinea found a lost tribe there. It had never been touched by civilizations in tens of thousands of years. And they showed them a lighter, and everybody in the whole village was like, whoa, you can make fire, you know, just like that. And they're like, yeah, you just wait until tomorrow when our seaplane arrives, you know, you're going to really see something then. So he gathers all the villagers and everything the next day out by the beach to see the seaplane coming in, expecting them to be totally shocked, you know, like wow, that's amazing. And the seaplane comes in and the villagers are like, so what? And he goes, well, what do you mean? And the explorer says, what do you mean?
You can make fire.
What do you mean, so what? And they say, well, of course you can fly. You can make fire come out of your thumb.
Right. You know, and it's kind of like a parallel to the cargo cults also around the World War II era. You know, these tribes that had never seen planes fly, they venerated airplanes and the beings that flew them and almost took them on as like gods because they had never seen technology such as that before. You know, and that's really what we're talking about as the current human condition. You know, there's been these people who have had the knowledge of how these two interrelated bodies of knowledge work. The one being how the psyche works, how the human mind works, and the other being how the laws of nature work. And if you combine those two areas of knowledge and you sequester it as much as possible from the bulk of the human population, and again, sequestering it, deliberately hiding it, deliberately holding it back, that's one way of keeping it occulted, okay, or hidden. Another is to simply dissuade people from looking into it verbally, you know, or put a group of people that you call the mainstream media in and just never talk about it and say, well, that's just fringe and we think that there's nothing to that, or only crazy people ever look into stuff like that. And therefore, you know, that you are dissuaded from ever going there. You know, it's like you don't even have to be held back from it. You just ridicule people for going there, and most people willfully say, I want no part of that knowledge because that's seen as the lunatic fringe. It's a very clever manipulatory tactic psychologically to make people stay away from information which they need more than anything else in life in order to better their condition, and they will shun it willfully if only you provide that ridicule factor for them, and they'll just fall right in line and say, there's nothing to see here.
Now, we still exist in a wish-to-be-dominated position, rather wish-to-be-led, okay? People aren't used to the idea of everybody's their own leader. Everybody has personal responsibility. Everybody has personal power. Nobody can tell me what to do. No, but I can't tell you what to do, and that's a fair and just society. We don't have that mentality. What we have is, oh, I just want to live my life and be left alone, and I hope the guys that are in power don't frack everything up for me. You know, it's living a dream.
Again, it's not only a dreamlike reality, but it's a child's mentality. It's like a child trusting a parent, you know?
Oh, my God. It's so true. It's so true. To believe that the state is absolutely necessary and you can't do without it and that it is your life-giving blood and sunshine and water is like believing in Santa Claus.
Right. It's a child's dreamlike world. Say, it always has been like this. It is this way now, and therefore it always needs to be like this, because this is all we've ever known. Again, returning to that theme of the shunning the unknown. You know, if you just look at this simple model, I actually laid this out a little bit last night in the presentation. If you just look at the simple model of what people want government to be in the modern day, okay, you have the so-called leftists, the Democrats here in America, maybe Labor Party in some other countries, you know, they're the quote unquote liberals, right? And I would qualify that and say they're certainly not classical liberals. They're what people would call neoliberals, okay? To put a political terminology onto it, to latch something like that onto it. But whatever term you want to group them into, what do they see government as? What do they want government to be? They see government as the nurturer and the provider. They want government to provide for everyone equally so that everybody has everything that they need. All needs are met. And that's what they feel the role of government should be. This institution that is backed by a monopoly of violence, you know, to do violence to other people, to put things the way they say it should be, by decree, by fiat.
For your own good.
So, oh, of course, always.
And for the children. Let's not forget the children.
Sure. But that's what you would say the left wants. They want government to be this nurturer and protector, like an archetypal mother figure.
The nanny state.
So, exactly. That's what it's been called traditionally. And this so accurately reflects the psychological dynamic that is at work. This is someone with mother abandonment issues at some level or in some form. There are abandonment issues toward the feminine or mother side. And therefore, in proxy, they want the government to fulfill the role on a mass scale of nurturer and provider, which is typically the archetypal motherly role. So that's the psychological dynamic that is actually at work deep in the nested regions of the psyche, in the human subconscious mind, that is leading people to want and crave government to play that role in their lives. It's simply mommy issues. It is motherly abandonment issues at work.
2 points I want to make.
Can we look at the opposite real quick? Look at the opposite, the right, the political right, right? What do they want? They don't want the same thing as the political left. They don't want government to play the same role or execute the same functions, okay? They see a completely different role for government. What do they want it to be? The political right, or what you would call the conservatives or the neocons, or, here in America, it's the Republican Party, okay? In other countries, I believe it's simply called Conservative Party, okay? They want the government to act as the protector. They want it to act as the policeman of the world, to go out, or at least here in America, that's certainly the case. They want it to be a strong central government and a strong father figure. So they're craving the opposite. That by proxy, they want government to play the role of father, of the archetypal father figure that actually keeps the family safe, keeps the family dynamic safe, and goes out and looks for danger and polices the environment, polices the world, if you will. And that is someone with psychological abandonment issues toward the fatherly side, someone with daddy issues, I would say. Mm. All you have to do is just look at the two basic dichotomies within the political spectrum, the false political spectrum at that, because it's all just control. It's all just slavery. But if you just look at those two seemingly polarized dynamics, you recognize they're at the core, underlying it, in the subconscious mind, it's unresolved abandonment issues that are at work.
Mm.
Parental abandonment issues.
Yeah, I see that a lot. And in fact, to talk about Zeitgeist and Bill Cooper, these are two things I wanted to mention before to illustrate your point, and I find that it illustrates both sides of the argument actually quite well, is that the Zeitgeist movement in New Zealand, I filmed for them like a number of years ago, you know, filming the screenings and little meetings and what have you. And I found that the guys who I'd go home with back to their place to hang out and what have you, that they all had really wealthy parents and were unemployed. And I thought, isn't that interesting that somebody who's had everything handed to them their entire life and doesn't have to work for a living is in favor of a society where all of the work is taken care of for them and they still don't have to work for a living? And then,
right. And
then there's Bill Cooper, who talked about socialism. This is what socialism is. You're living at home with daddy. Now, he pays for your roof. He gives you your food. But if you want to go to the next town to go to a party, you have to ask daddy's permission.
Right.
If daddy tells you to do something, you have to do it. You have to do the dishes. You have to take out the garbage.
Right.
You don't actually have any freedom. You're a slave. And so what we've got here, and I think you've identified this quite well, is the false left-right paradigm, which is that kind of I want my parents to take care of me and not have to do anything myself personally, versus I want daddy to take care of me and I don't want to be able to do things of my own volition. I want somebody to tell me what to do. I want somebody to define the parameters of my life. So not only do I not want to do anything with my life, I want somebody else to define for me what I can and can't do as well.
Exactly. And what does that ultimately do? It absolves you of your personal responsibility to actually go out into the world, do the right thing, and make something worthwhile with your life, and then basically help to teach and propagate those ideas to other people. And therefore you're shunning personal responsibility and you're striving to remain that psychological child. So that's ultimately what this is all about. It's about nested deep down in the subconscious mind through whatever traumas may have put it there, unresolved parental abandonment issues. And that's what the presentation last night, I led with this notion that what we're really dealing with at the core level is unresolved abandonment issues. And there's a larger framework of abandonment that has happened in the ancient past that may have dealt with who our quote unquote cosmic parents were as a species. And that's what I then got deeply into as part of the presentation, which, like I said, I'll just offer that as a teaser and people can check out the video in their own time once it goes up. But you know, people will hear this and they'll say, well, you know, many people can't accept that neither one of these sides is true. You know, if you're not for socialism, then you must be for fascism. If you don't support the conservative agenda, then you must be a neoliberal. When I tell people I don't believe in money at all, I think the monetary system is a fake religion that has been given to us as a mechanism of control. They say socialist, communist. I'm neither of those things. I think socialism and communism are among the greatest evils in the world. Okay. And nor am I a rampant capitalist that believes in money and the so-called anarcho-capitalist system. You know, I think all monetary systems need to abolish. I am for the expansion of consciousness to a level where people recognize that we are one. Now, again, that doesn't mean worldwide communism either. Okay. So think about this. Right? If you truly recognize that you're a family, let's say a real, actual, like nuclear style family, a mother, a father, and two children, right? Let's say you place them out in the wilderness, right? Would they develop a monetary system among themselves?
No.
Would that make sense?
Not if they were on their own. I mean, monetarism has only really become much of a threat since its inception of being able to print out more money than you've actually got. You know, the gold hoarders and all of that kind of stuff, just printing out paper receipts and golds that they just didn't have. And that's the inherent evil within. That's the inherent
evil. It's become rampantly evil since that.
And that's how they manage to use. It's kind of like money to me is a representation of energy. Now, the thing is, I have to sweat, I have to work, I have to dig a shovel in a ground for several hours in order to get this much note representation of energy.
Right.
It's not fair or just or moral for somebody to click a few keyboard buttons and have this much energy for themselves.
Sure, sure. And nor is it fair for somebody to say, I'm going to impose taxation and say, you did this amount of labor, I'm going to take this and redistribute it where I see fit to redistribute it, because I think that's the right thing to do. Both of these concepts are inherently wrong. In addition to that, rampant greed would also be inherently immoral and say, I'm just going to acquire as much as I can without any looking at anybody else, what they may need or how they may be suffering, and I'm just going to just hoard all of this just for myself and whoever else be damned. Mm-hmm. You know, all of these aspects are wrong.
Yeah.
So, you know, people from different aspects of the political spectrum hear things that I'm saying, and they all get offended, you know? It's offending people on all sides of the equation.
In fact, that's what I've been saying for years, Mark, is that I offend both sides of every major argument.
Right.
You know why?
Sure.
Because the reason why those both major arguments have been going on for so long is because both of them are wrong, and they hate
that's
me
right.
because I'm right.
That's right. There's a truth that isn't involved in that dichotomy and that internal opposition that's going on there between those two limited sides of that debate. There's another aspect to it that is actually the truth of the matter. So the truth of the matter is we are that family in the wilderness. That's the truth of the matter. Mm-hmm. Now, would the mother look at the father doing some physical labor and say, I'm going to take that just for me, and you must continue to do this, and I'm going to take as much as I can, and I'll let you know how much you may keep. The mother probably would never do anything like that if she really truly cares about the husband and her children. They would work together, and they would see themselves as one. They would not see themselves as separate. Would the father who just did some work to grow some vegetables say to the daughter who he's trying to help and support and help to live and thrive and survive and grow and have a quality of life, you're going to have to give me something in return for your meal today? No. He would do the work that would be required, and it would be shared amongst the family. So would the children get involved in when they could doing that work that would be necessary for their survival.
Mm.
It would be a cooperative effort. Now, people hear commune in this. I'm not advocating communism. I'm saying that cooperation that is voluntary and done because people see the inherent oneness in all beings. That's the level of consciousness that we need to get to. When we do that, we can develop a gift economy that would not require exchange of imaginary notes or credits or any kind of, what they call a chitless society, any kind of chit or little representation of wealth. You know, people insist that the idea of money in general is an exchange system. And I also reject that. And that seems like a foreign concept to many people too, that, well, you're saying money's not an exchange system. Yes, I'm saying money is not an exchange system. It is not even there, is not even designed to be there to ameliorate exchange of goods and services. When
can I say
look
something?
At this, sure.
money is kind of like, when people say it's an exchange system, that means that money is a funnel. You pour something in one end and it gets concentrated down here, and you can keep it and take it away, kind of thing, you know, storable wealth of some kind. But it's not like that. It's actually more like one of those little things that you've got inset into your sink that you pour stuff into it and it grinds it up and turns it into mush. That's what money system actually does.
Pretty much.
It destroys and compacts society down until there's nothing left, until everything that was once owned collectively by people that they shared anyway and took care of just because they could and just because they should, hey, that doesn't frickin' exist anymore. It's all in a few hands who destroy it.
Because what gets brought into a system where there is a differential put in place, like a monetary system, and you have haves and have-nots, and you have those who prosper and do really well and those who are poor and do more poorly in it, is ego. Ego is the dynamic that gets brought into that. It's saying, always saying, what's in this for me? Okay, now I'm not going to try to tell you that there would be no selfishness with, you know, or just possibly even just outright laziness in a system, especially in a transitory system that was abandoning a monetary system. Of course you are going to have issues and problems like that and some level of chaos like that in moving from a hierarchically organized and completely a differential organized system like a monetary system to something like a gift economy. Mm. What I'm trying to get at is, what is the underlying consciousness shift that would be required to do away with a control system called money? See, that's what people don't understand. They look at it as an ameliorating exchange system instead of a control of energy system. See, people look at money and they call it currency. One of the reasons I feel that it was deliberately named currency is to equate it with word magic, psychologically, with the idea of current, which is the flow in a system, whether it be water or electricity or otherwise. Okay? Current is the flow inside of a system, the rate of flow. Now, when you look at money as the current in the system, I feel that's the exact wrong model to look at it as. Okay? What it is the resistance in the system. If we're talking about DC current here, or you could call it the impedance in a system if we're talking about AC electricity, okay? So that's what it really does. It impedes the flow, the natural flow, okay, by putting reducing the consciousness to ego identification and what do I have to get out of this exchange? How do I have to profit from this exchange? And I understand the concept of adding value. I get that, you know, if you bake bread, you took, you know, grains and, you know, added value to that and made something that didn't exist in that form before, and therefore you added value by doing that work. I get that. What I'm trying to explain is the level of consciousness that we need to get away from this control system is to understand money is not the currency in the system, the current in the system. It is the limitation in the flow of energy that prevents goods and services from flowing to people if it is not present. Okay? So by making that present, you're putting an impedance in the system. Naturally, if the consciousness that would be there without that monetary system would allow those goods and services to flow naturally, and there would be no impedance in that system if we were to be able to come up to that level of consciousness. Most people who cannot imagine a monetary system not existing are at too low of a level of consciousness to even conceive of how that can work. And what I call that is perfect mind control. I call that the perfected form of mind control, because the greatest form of mind control is one where you have controlled the thinking of the being to such an extent that they cannot even imagine that it could be any other way. It is what I have called the death of the imagination. The only way that we could ever create something that is better than what we have now is to first imagine that it can be better and it can be a different way. If you are so mind controlled through indoctrination and repetition and hardened attachment to a belief system, okay, to an institutionalized belief system and a religion, which is what money is, the imagination is completely stifled and choked, and you cannot even imagine in your mind, okay, mentally, that it could possibly not exist and people could be okay as a result, even with this system gone. And admittedly, I would say that can only work if consciousness evolves to a point where we see ourselves as that family out in the wilderness with all the same basic drives and desires and requirements and needs, and we get the ego out of the way and say we are of one nature, we are of one fundamental unity and oneness at a unified level, at a spiritual level, and we are going to treat each other as such. You know, would you deprive someone of a family member, a very close family member, like a child, of food if they couldn't pay you for it as their parent? Or would you, as someone else's sister or brother or nephew or aunt or, you know, whoever, would you say, I'm going to deprive you of food or resources or shelter or something because you can't give me something in exchange for it?
I call that dynamic where everybody's giving everybody just a little of something and not expecting anything back, yet getting it back in some way, some forth, the perpetual reciprocal mooch phenomenon. All right?
Right. So what have you just described, Vinny? You've described current in a system. That's what that is. It's a flow, a free flow of energy without impedance. You've just described it in a nutshell brilliantly.
Yeah. And I do consider myself to be rather the master of being a perpetual mooch. I mean, think about it. I have not had a day slave job in like 6 years. And I have not gone without food, not gone without water, not gone without shelter, not gone without internet, not gone without gas. Okay, it all
when
comes
you step
to me
into
somehow.
The truth, when you step into the truth, the universe provides. I like how Jack Blood describes it: "Be bold, and mighty forces will come to your aid." Yeah. You know, if you're standing in the truth, that impedance is going to drop away, and there's going to be free flow in the system. I absolutely know that that's the case, and you know, you do this nonstop. You know, I look at it like, hey, I put out podcasts infrequently. I used to do a weekly radio show. I don't know how guys like you do it. You know, people like you, people like Bob Tuscan, people like even Alex Jones. I mean, to do this every day, it's unbelievable. Like, I look at you guys as almost superhuman. Like, it's like if I did what I do every single day without any stopping and break, like even a 5 day a week thing, I don't know how you do it. I would be so burnt out. It would be unbelievable. But like you said, as long as you're continuously giving and providing freely, that system is going to open up and it's going to provide energy to you. It's kind of like how I feel at a presentation or when I'm really locked into the zone giving a podcast or something. While you may feel somewhat physically drained and it's like an effort to continue on, you're also feeling an energy upwelling and you get like this rush because you're doing what really needs to be done. See, I described it. We went to a restaurant in the area after the presentation I gave last night, and I was talking to some people about this dynamic, and they were saying, how do you continue on even, or maybe even like, you know, don't you ever get depressed thinking, oh, the world's really messed up, and knowing what you know, I don't know how you continue to do what you do, even though, you know, a lot of people are still completely asleep and haven't even begun this quest or this journey into truth. And I tried to explain it like how I see this is I'm not controlled by the will of Mark Passio. Okay, the individuated being, like the image, the visage that you're seeing here on the screen. That's not the will that controls me, okay? Or that's not the will that I'm directed by. I'm directed by what I would call the capital W will. What I want, what Mark wants, okay, is that lowercase W will, that little W will, okay? That's not what directs the work that I do, or where I am summoning or pulling the energy from with what I need to do in the world. A higher will is directing that purpose and that flow of energy. I simply try to get my ego to stand out of the way and step into the slipstream of that will, and then, you know, the energy is provided. Mm-hmm. So that's how I look at it. I look at it as we have to step into that slipstream of the higher will, what has been called will with a capital W, or the will of creation, or some people have simply called it the will of God, and I have no problem with that term either. Mm-hmm. I think that's where that infinite energy really comes from, ultimately.
Yeah. And coffee. Now, if I could explain, this is how I do everything. I create shortcuts and cut out things that are unnecessary. All right? That's the only reason why I'm able to do 5-day-a-week radio show with 5 archived radio shows, 5 archived videos that are edited with 2 camera angles and everything like that every single day. It's the reason why I'm able to cut together a slideshow documentary in a night, is because I cut out the bullshit. All right.
Right.
And this is precisely what you're famous for. can you see it there? It's Passio, right? It wipes out that bullshit, man.
That's right.
Yeah.
Purification. That's what it's all about.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, it really is that apophatic process of taking away what's unrequired, what's not required. You know, again, going back to solutions, when people ask me what's the first thing I should be doing, what can I do if I don't know about any of this and I'm just starting out? I tell people get on to purifying the body, you know, because you have to get the physical toxins out. You know, I look at juicing as a great way of doing that, and you think about what that's doing. It's breaking down the nutrient density in the food to get that into the cells, and that acts as a cleansing mechanism. You know, different kinds of juices act as cleanses to the body because you're putting distilled water, and that carries away a lot of inorganic impurities in the body. You know, and we have to do the same thing with our mind. You know, I love the example that the researcher Michael Tesarion, again, always gives about sanity, you know, in regard to sanitation, cleaning the mind, cleaning the psyche. You know, we would not dream of taking a dinner plate, putting food on it, eating dinner, leaving the scraps and remnants and the detritus of whatever meal we had just eaten, okay, leaving that on the plate to cake up night after night after night, and putting more food on the plate and eating from that same dirty plate night after night after night. Wow. No one would dream of doing that.
That's,
you know,
gross.
We would go get a new plate at the very least, or we would clean that plate and put food on a clean plate. We're not doing that psychological cleansing. We're not doing that emotional cleansing. And we think that that's going to lead to something that is palatable or healthy. It can't lead to anything that's going to be palatable and healthy. It can only lead to disease. It can only lead to discomfort. It can only lead to breakdown and decay and chaos. So that will that we have to summon to do that work on ourselves to purify in all these different ways has to be slowly built up, like a person who is coming out of a situation where their muscles are atrophied, and they'd have to start with some small weights, do things in a small stepwise progression, and eventually build up to the big weights.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. It is a good way to take it slowly and take it gently, and kind of like, I had a realization the other day, Mark. I want to share this with you. I realized that the knowledge that I possess, a lot of people think that I'm older than I am. I'm only 28. Because I've accumulated such knowledge firsthand from researchers like yourself and many others, because I interview like 5 different people a week, give or take.
Of course.
And so what dawned on me is that I haven't actually earned any of this knowledge. I haven't actually deeply researched into it to read all those books and do all of that really, you know, what I consider the real work. Right? I'm just a douchebag with a microphone helping people who do the real work, like the real research and what have you, get their words and messages and knowledge out there for people who were previously
sure.
completely unaware of them. Not because that one interview that I do with said person in and of itself is enough, but because a listener might hear that one interview and go, wow,
that person had something there. Do they have more content? Yes, they do. Hey, here's the website link on the VinnieEastonShow.com. And then they can go and start researching into that, because I think there's two types of people in the world. You know, everybody says, oh, there's two types of people, and there's millions of different examples about what those two types of people are.
Sure.
But in my case, there are generalists, multidisciplinaries kind of thing, and then there are specialists, right?
Right.
Specialists are incredibly useful at particular items, particularly research, certain skills such as, I don't know, engineering and what have you. You'll have these individual specialists who are just geniuses at doing these one really complicated, really difficult thing that nobody else can do. Generalists, on the other hand, they'll know about those particular things that nobody else can do except that guy. Kind of instead of being a jack of all trades, they're a jack of all aces, you know? Like, you know a little bit about a lot of knowledge, so that if something comes up in a conversation or comes up on a work site or something of that nature, you're capable of filtering through multiple spectrums of information in order to look at it holistically and find the best possible solution. Even if you don't actually possess the actual skills and actual knowledge to get it implemented, you can still point people in the right direction.
Absolutely. And I think that's very important for people to become generalists. The term in different, you know, maybe occult schools of thought, or just, you know, the how academia or intelligentsia might look at this is a polymath. That's the term that they will generally use for this. Someone that has a lot of knowledge about many different areas or topics of knowledge. And that's what really we need to strive to become, I feel, are polymaths. So we need to be generalists. And that's not to say specialization, as you pointed out, is not important, because it is absolutely important. But we can't, in other words, we can't lose sight of the forest for the trees. When we focus in with laser-like precision, you can't lose sight of the big picture. So it's okay to be a specialist on a particular topic or issue or, you know, school of thought or, you know, a skill set or whatever. But everybody in their own way should be a generalist as well, and be able to understand how the big pattern, the tapestry fits together, because this is ultimately about pattern recognition. That's what consciousness really ultimately is. It's about being able to recognize patterns, not only what's going on within us in our own internal makeup, but of course to recognize the patterns that are taking place around us in our environment. That's what consciousness ultimately is all about.
Now, I think we should probably take another break or wrap up the show, because I'd be willing to talk for another hour if you want to take a break and then come back.
I think this is a good place to wrap it up if you want to do that. And we could just put people onto my site and they can go there for, again, as you said, you point them in that direction. They can go there for further research. And on my site, I do that all the time as well. I try to point out people that I felt have helped me tremendously in my awakening process and in the knowledge that I have accrued. And, you know, there's that old saying, if I have seen further, it is because I have stood upon the shoulders of giants. You know, these other researchers in these fields, in these alternative research fields, they've done this work to an extent. And, you know, nature builds on top of pre-existing systems in many cases. It uses what is already there. And, you know, the concept that everything has to be brand new and, you know, nobody's going to just take something and aggregate it, you know? I tell people, you're not going to see things that are brand new here. I might have some insights that some people may not have said in the same way, but this is just all here. It's always all been here. The truth has always been here among us. It's our job to recognize it and then learn it, take it in, and then speak it to other people so that they may also recognize it. So, you know, the concept that there is nothing new under the sun, that is a saying that comes out of a lot of mystery school traditions, is something that highly resonates with me. And I always have to kind of chuckle at people who say, oh, there's nothing new here in what this person is saying, and he's just rehashing some things or conglomerating or aggregating information. I take that as a badge of honor. That's what I do. I am aggregating information. Yeah. And I think that's a great skill set to have.
Yeah.
I'm an aggregator of information. When you do that effectively for people in a way that is logically organized, okay, and helps people to make sense of information, they're suddenly able to see a tapestry and a pattern that they may not have been able to see before. So I take that actually as a badge of honor and a compliment when people say that. There is nothing new under the sun, ladies and gentlemen. It has always been here. It is up to us to recognize and see the pattern and then share that with others. So I'd like to just say that first, and then I'll just give my my website so people can go do some further research on their own, and they could also see some of the people who I share information from and check out their research as well. And a lot of those links and documents are on my website also. So you could go to my website, whatonearthishappening.com. And I highly recommend people. The videos are great to check out. A lot of people like to start there. My personal recommendation is the audio is the real core, the bulk of the material. I suggest going to the podcast section and, of course, working your way through progressively in order at your own pace without skipping around from number one forward through to the most recent ones. So the website, once again, is whatonearthishappening.com. And Vinny, I want to just thank you for once again for this great opportunity to come on your show and share this information with people.
It's vice versa. Now, you know that John F. Kennedy quote that I sent you?
Yes.
Would you like...
Excellent. Excellent soundbite, by the way.
I think that this would be a good time to actually play that to close up the show so sure. That the listeners can hear it. And when I first heard this quote last night, I'd never heard this speech from John F. Kennedy. And it was in a Justice League cartoon, of all things. And I actually wept because it occurred to me how great these words are, how we can cast spells with vowels and consonants, how we can inspire men to be more than they are just right. Through our words.
And
we have those people killed because they threatened the dominance of the slavery system. That was what really upset me.
But for every individual that they'll take down in that fashion, and now it's becoming increasingly dangerous to their agenda what they want to accomplish to do that in any form of an open way, okay? For every warrior like that gets taken down that was waking up and trying to share some truth with other people, I feel that 100 or 1,000 will rise in their place. There's not going to be any stopping this progression. I think it's just going to be a matter of, you know, how much suffering is going to be required if people continue to hold on and cling to these outmoded and outdated systems that don't serve us anymore. But I think it's ultimately inevitable, and they know it, and that's why they're ultimately clamoring to try to maintain control. And that really means that they're running scared in the long run, because you know, the truth is not going to be held down forever, and there are people who are going to come forward in a dedicated way to speak it without apology, okay? Speak it unapologetically and put it out there for people without fear. And that's ultimately what it's all about, and that's what enables people to, again, see the big picture, see the pattern, and then hopefully get involved in that dynamic and get involved on that spiritual battlefield to take that information out to other people in as open and as free of a way as possible.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. Well, let's just open up this wee audio track here, this quote from John Fitzgerald Kennedy. May God rest his soul.
Pioneers gave up their safety, their comfort, and sometimes their lives to build our new West. They were determined to make the new world strong and free, an example to the world. Some would say that those struggles are all over, that all the horizons have been explored, that all the battles have been won, that there is no longer an American frontier. And we stand today on the edge of a new frontier, the frontier of unknown opportunities and perils. Beyond that frontier are uncharted areas of science and space, unsolved problems of peace and war, unconquered province of ignorance and prejudice. I'm asking each of you to be pioneers towards that new frontier. My call is to the young in heart, regardless of age. Can we carry through in an age where we will witness not only new breakthroughs in weapons of destruction, but also a race for mastery of the sky and the rain, the ocean and the tides, the far side of space, and the inside of men's minds? All mankind waits upon our decision. A whole world looks to see what we shall do. And we cannot fail that trust, and we cannot fail to try.
That's right. We can't fail to try, you know. No matter how hopeless the situation, there's still inspiration out there. So, ladies and gentlemen, I hope you enjoyed this little episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show. I know I certainly have. I was like, on our break in the midway through the show mark, I was like just making myself a coffee going, fuck yeah, I'm interviewing my fucking patio. You know, and it's not like some kind of idle sort of BS. It's more like, thank Frank, I have the opportunity to talk to such great men from all around the world every day for a living. And I made that happen. I organized it, I recorded it, and I'm putting it out there for people, and I'm inherently excited about my existence in and of itself.
And in turn, Vinny, thank God we have people like you. Thanks so much for what you do.
Yeah. Well, you're welcome. All right. Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for listening, and you can check out all the archives, and please donate, because this is a listener-supported show, at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com, because it's Christmas, we need the money for presents and stuff. See you again sometime, folks.
Summer with the skills they got.